You're listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast from New York City. I'm Jeremy Bent. I was the guest on a previous episode, but today I'm back as your host for another round of our ongoing La Ronde. Today my guest is Jesse Lee, who improv fans might know from Monstro, Dreadnought, Tesla, and currently Mermaids. Jesse, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Glad to have you as my guest.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah. So why don't we just start at the beginning, what got you into improv? Like, what brought you to UCB and to doing long form?
So I started doing improv in college. I went to Haverford College.
Okay.
It's a small liberal arts college outside Philadelphia. And actually, there were like two improv groups there, which is like kind of funny because it was only like 1,200 students.
There were I think three improv groups at my college, but my school's huge.
Yeah, right, right. It's so like the per capita improv group
yeah,
to
very
student
high.
Ratio.
Very, very high.
So it was like a very, I think like, comedy hungry, I don't know, the student body was into it. So, but we, every semester we'd invite like a Herald team down and, we had, Dillinger come down 1 year, then we had the Shoves.
Wow. Good choices.
Then we had 1985, Juan came 1 year. So we basically had like,
that's like the hits
yeah,
of Herald
like
Night
were,
for
I
like,
mean,
wow.
Yeah, at that time, those were, I feel like those were the best teams to see to get into improv.
Oh, absolutely. So I raved last week about Fwand, but 85 and like all those teams are great.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, as a person learning the form, they were like gods. Like what they did was magical.
Oh,
so,
100%. Yeah.
Like the first show I ever saw was actually the student improv group, I think it was the Throng who had actually invited them. That was
the team. Edgar, okay.
So they invited them and, I just went cause one of my friends was in the show and
sure.
Then we saw, the Shoves do a Herald and it was like utterly mind blowing. And then, so from that moment I was like, I didn't know what this was before, but I want to do this.
There is definitely a moment, especially with the Herald, where you see one done really, really well. And
right.
You're just like, oh damn.
Yeah. Right. You know? Yeah, I didn't know like that even existed. And so, you know, I grew up like watching comedy and like sort of being adjacent to it, but never like considering myself someone who could participate in it in a way, you know? So
improv is weird because it just doesn't translate to video the same
right.
way.
Yeah.
And so you really do have to see it live to like get what the deal is.
Right. And I think like having friends who are in the group and, you know, being at their show and then, you know, being adjacent to them, talking about it, I felt like kind of pulled me into it, made it more accessible in a way.
So you were not in the group?
I was not in the group when I first saw improv. Yeah.
Okay.
But then I joined the group the next year.
You were, I got to do this.
Yeah, so I got to do that. I auditioned, and then I got in the fall. Since then, my family lives in New York, so every time.
Oh.
Yeah, so every summer when I go home from school, I would take a UCB class.
Makes sense, sure.
And then I'd go back to school with, like, all the 101 and 201
learning.
I got
a bunch of secrets.
Yeah. Right, right, right. That's sort of how I got into it. And then when I graduated, I just moved out here because, you know, obviously I live with my parents. And then for a summer till I got a job, and then I moved to New York too. So do UCB stuff. So
yeah, totally. Yeah. So who were like the teachers when you were coming up? Anybody? I raved about Gethard last time. I was
yeah.
There.
So when I took my 101 with Charlie Todd, and then 201 with Charlie Sanders.
Oh, great. Good Charlies
yeah,
to have.
It was a succession of Charlies. they were both great. I think from my 101 class, there weren't a ton of people still around. I think Brandon Scott Jones was in my class.
Oh, okay.
I think, yeah, Charlie Sanders, I felt like he was someone, you know, he was on the Shoves. And so
sure.
I took a class with him, and he was someone who, like, I took 201 with him. He's like, that's like a tough level in general.
It's tricky. Yeah. I don't disagree.
Right. And he was also someone who like, was so funny and for that reason was very intimidating in class.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so, I remember, yeah, Charlie being, an active teacher then. I feel like Gether was also teaching. I didn't take a class with him until later. But yeah, I think all the Swarm guys were like teaching as well. Yeah, I took 301 with Tanoy.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah. So basically, I blew through the classes. Once I graduated and I moved, I just basically was in class constantly.
Yeah. A common phenomenon.
Right.
I feel like.
Yeah. It also helped. I became an intern, so then with the intern program,
you're just more involved.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I think I basically just like threw myself into UCB.
It happens a lot, but it's also like, well, it's a good way to do it. You're going to learn a lot about improv. You're going to see a lot of great shows.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be able to like talk about it with people who have strong opinions about it.
Yeah. Especially I feel like coming out of college, UCB does have that kind of extended college vibe in a
definitely.
Way. Because you're in class. It's like a new social scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're like everyone's kind of working on like a shared goal that they're working on.
Right. Everyone's got like a project.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And speaking of, I guess the equivalent is like everyone's got like groups in college they're really serious about, and I feel like the equivalent in the UCB community is like indie teams.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
Where it's like people get, I think when people have good indie teams, they get really, or maybe it's the other way around, where like when you get really serious about it, you get a really good indie
team. Right.
And like for me, that's Thank You Robot, but for you, like both Dreadnought and Tesla were both great indie teams that I loved watching.
Yeah, those were, I feel like, two teams that kind of, were really big milestones in terms of, like, for me getting a chance to, first of all, Tesla was, like, a group that really focused on hosting a great indie show.
Yeah, and having been a band that played at your indie show,
I
can attest that, like, the Tesla show was a fun show.
Yeah. So what we would do is we rented Players Theater, and then we basically saw, like, we just looked at groups like Rogue Elephant, who put on, like, the indie show you wanted to perform at if you were an indie team. And so we were like, yeah, we want to do that. So we got a band. You played in the band. We had a live band play every show, and then we would just have it had kind of like that, I don't know, that fun kind of party vibe that that was like something that was important to us too.
It definitely had a fun party vibe.
Yeah,
it was great.
And I think like part of the reason we wanted to do that was just because as an indie performer, you always want stage time, but you want stage time that feels like there's stakes to it. And sometimes that's hard to come by.
I was talking about this with Aaron last week where, like, we've all done those, like, Triple Crown and Creek shows where you're like, why is no one taking this show seriously?
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating.
Yeah. It's not fun for anybody.
No, it's really not.
Yeah. So, we put a lot of time and effort into making a show that everyone wanted to be at, and that people would want to come to even if they weren't performing.
Exactly, and it makes people step up their game a little bit.
Right, yeah. I would say at times we put more effort into producing the show than our actual set, but it was still like, it was fun. It was something that we all put a lot of energy to making good.
But it's like, if the show is fun,
yeah,
it's hard to have a bad set, is how I feel. Like, if everyone's like having a good time and like, there's like, you've got all these like bits that you're doing as part of the show and everyone feels like, hey, this is like a fun show.
Yeah.
It's almost hard to do a bad improv show.
Yeah. I wouldn't say we did bad shows, but we definitely like we were into creating like the vibe of like a Saturday night party. I think that also helped being in like Players Theater is also a great venue.
Players Theater, an excellent indie venue that I completely failed to mention last week when talking about great indie venues.
Right.
But that is a winner. It's got a good, I think, let's talk about what makes a good indie improv venue.
I would say, I think location is very important.
True.
I think that's one of the things that, like, there's under St. Mark's.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the big benefits of that venue is that it wasn't just, like, a great location.
Yeah.
Afterwards, there's, like, a million bars you could go.
It, like, makes sense to go there on, like, a Friday or Saturday night.
Right.
But same with Players Theater. It's, like, right in that, West 4th area.
Right.
Very convenient, but also, like, stuff to do before and after.
Right. I think what I like about players and under St. Mark's is that they feel like kind of intimate with the audience in a way.
You're very close to the audience.
Yeah.
Which is good for improv.
Right. Players has like a little bit more, more of like a bigger, I would say it has, I mean, there's more seats, first of all.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's like raised seating. I guess, yeah.
Under St. Mark's
has
like,
raised seating too. But it's also, like, I don't know, for some reason under St. Mark's is a little bit more intimate too.
Yeah, under St. Mark's is like, well, Players is very wide.
Right.
And so, like, you have a little bit more room to play, which is great.
Yeah.
But also the audience is a little more spread out.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
in under St. Mark's, the audience is like a very condensed mass directly mm-hmm. in front of you.
Right. I think, like, a lot of the venues that people, like, talk about when they think of, like, tough indie shows
yeah.
always have, like, a really cramped stage, right? I
mm-hmm.
feel like that's one of the most yep. chief complaints.
It's like...
Like, Rafiki used to have a very...
Rafiki had the smallest stage on
yeah.
planet Earth. It was, like, 6x6.
Right, right. yeah, there's another venue I can't remember off the top of my head.
Where was
like
it?
A super... It was in another... It was another, like, East Village type...
Oh, was it Mo Pitkins?
It might have been... I'm maybe thinking of, like, The Lantern...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Village Lantern.
Yeah, Village Lantern. Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm. They had, like, a super narrow stage. And I remember trying to do, like, a very physical set on that, and it wasn't working out.
Yeah, sometimes it's very hard.
Yeah.
But both of those places, great stages.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like you can't get that far away from the show.
Right.
Because, like, both the Creek and... I feel like I'm picking on these places,
mm-hmm.
but they're so long
yeah.
that you can almost hide from the show
right,
while
right.
you're there, which
yeah.
I think is bad.
And I think the audience feels that way too. And
yeah.
it's like they, I think they, if you give an audience member space to not be invested, I think it sometimes
yeah,
makes
they're not going to,
yeah. Right. So yeah, Tesla was like a big indie team for me. Dreadnought was also a big indie team. We all came out of, Chris Gethard class, and I feel like that group for me was important because I think up to that point I had been trying to learn in classes how to be a good improviser, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like how to like be a good Harold Knight improviser, because that's something that I wanted to be on Harold
Knight.
And
that's like sort of what the classes are focused
right,
on.
Right, yeah.
You
it's
know?
Like how to fit a certain structure. And I feel like that Chris Gethard class and working with Dreadnought, I feel like I learned how to be the best version of what Jesse Lee does.
Yes.
Like how to what my strengths are and like what my sensibility is and like how to do that better rather than trying to fit this mold of how to be a quote unquote improviser.
Right. Now, when you say Chris Gethard class, are you talking about parentheses?
No, I'm talking about so there Chris Gethard, like there was like 504, I guess was what they were called
oh,
back
right.
then.
So
he started teaching these
like scene study or something.
Yeah,
like that.
These like 4-week classes that were like all. I don't think there was like a set. Curriculum necessarily, but it was just like Gethard would get people to do weird things, which I at the point in time when I was taking those classes was something I kind of very badly needed to
yeah
to work
break
on.
Out of
yeah,
like
right.
like just try strange stuff
right. And so I think that you know Dreadnought was a bunch of people who were kind of like minded. One thing that I feel like we were characterized by like having a chip on our shoulder because we all like felt like we wanted to, I don't know, we kind of wanted to attack the stage in a way that I feel like we weren't either seeing or we weren't able to do at that point with other groups or in class or whatever. We just wanted a place to do that. So that was a group of folks who came together to do that. I remember one time, I feel like the peak Dreadnought show was when we did a...
Is this the show at the sushi restaurant?
Yes. So what happened was Gethard, I think, got this email from this guy named Elvis who used to own this place, Deo Sushi.
Mm.
And he was like a very odd fellow. He had a website where he was like, he proclaimed himself as a futurist. And he had
I remember
like,
this.
Yeah, it had all these like conspiracy theories
yep.
about like time travel and like lizard people.
Sure.
And so Gethard emailed us and was like, I think you guys should do this show. Elvis was basically like asking for
hey, like,
comedy
can
performers.
An,
yeah.
Can a comedy show come and
yeah.
perform at my restaurant?
Yes, which is not set up for a performance venue at all. And so we were like, okay, I guess so. We're doing this. And then so we get to the restaurant. It's clear that none of the patrons are expecting or
no.
want an improv
mm-hmm.
show to happen, but we kind of move some tables around and we start doing a show in the corner and it's I think there's a video of it. I was going to say I wasn't there,
uh-huh. but I can. I know I've heard it.
Right.
Like, because I can remember Don Finelli, like, basically begging people to start watching you.
And yes.
It, like, turns it into, like, a song, sort
right. of. Right, yeah. We started. There was a chant going. There was also a microphone and an amp. So I think.
Okay, so that's something.
You know, it quickly became, I would say, a battle with the audience. They started heckling us.
Which is what you really want a good show to be, of like a fight between you and the audience.
Yeah, right. At one point, someone hurled a racial epithet at me.
Oh, wow.
And then people went outside and exchanged words, but it was just all part of the show. We were performing. I don't think anyone else was performing.
Oh, dear.
It was kind of like insane in like a good way, you know. I feel like, to me, like, that show, I feel like, was important because it kind of I learned that you're never gonna have an improv show that's going to destroy you, right?
Yeah.
Like, fearing, there's no sense in fearing failure on stage, just because, you know, once you've done a shit show like that,
yeah,
you know, what's the worst that can happen in your indie show or your Herald show on?
Thank You Robot also performed at a restaurant.
Yeah.
And it was a truly terrible show, but it was like, well, we still did it.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of, yeah, it's hard to think like, well, I made it out of that show.
Right.
Surely I can make it out of another show that doesn't go well.
Yeah.
Because it would be hard for a show to go worse than that, you know?
Right. Like, you don't get a laugh, and what's the worst that happens? Nothing happens.
It's like nothing happens, yeah. Right?
So, yeah, that was like, I feel like, one of the most, I feel like, important lessons that I took from that team. It also came, Dreadnought also came at a time when, like, a bunch of us were getting on Herald Knight.
Yes.
At the time, there was only one Herald Knight. There wasn't Lloyd Knight.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Like, new teams are kind of thrown in, and
Herald Knight was
very
before
different.
Lloyd Knight, it was a lot more uneven,
yeah.
I think is fair to say.
Right. It was more uneven, and I feel like, at least from my experience, being on, you know, a couple teams, there was like a lot of, I feel like, unspoken fear in a way. And I don't know if there's like, I don't know if that's the, like, you know, having been on Lloyd Knight as well, I think there is some of that, if, in a way, some of that, those feelings can get kind of, being on a new team in that kind of stage is already nerve wracking.
Oh,
and so
absolutely.
I feel like being on the same, like, you know, having, coming up through the system and having built it up in my head, you know, I've personally felt like a lot of, anxiety about living up to whatever I thought the standard of quality should be.
I definitely thought for the entire first 6 months I was on Herald Knight, I was like, I have done no good scenes.
Right.
I've done nothing but bad scenes.
Right. And it's I mean, Herald Knight back then, I feel like for me, performing on that stage, I wasn't enjoying it in a way that I thought I would.
So so let's back up just a second.
Yeah, yeah.
So your first Herald team, that's what?
Monstro. Yeah.
Monstro, legendary for continuing to talk about themselves.
Yes, we still have an email chain going. We email regularly. Monstro is a great team that I love. It's a bunch of like really strong
folks.
It is
a bunch of really funny people.
Yeah, when we do reunion shows, I think they're like a blast. But like at the time for me, I was like really in my head, really nervous, and I don't think I was playing from fear. And
yeah.
I think that was
which is
kind of
always
tough,
a great
you know?
Place to play from.
Yeah, it's
like,
a
I'm
perfect
afraid,
mindset.
So let
comedy.
Me do this.
Yeah, right, right.
But I totally understand that of like, oh, I got on here, it took me so long to get here,
right.
I can't blow this.
Yeah.
And so there's no way you do your best improv with that mindset.
Right. It's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, I think it was a similar problem with what I was talking about before of like wanting to fit a certain mold of improviser, right? Like feeling like I had to be a certain type of person.
I need to do a textbook great Herald.
Yeah, like I didn't believe that I could do second beats, you know?
That's a problem.
Yeah, I think that kind of held me back a lot.
Yeah.
And so eventually I got cut from Herald Knight. And that was like, I think, a really important moment for me because I like that was the thing I feared the most in the back of my head.
I feel like there is a big stigma about talking about like even just talking about people who got cut, like mm-hmm. not even yourself getting cut of like, oh, I I shouldn't talk about, like, because they got cut. I don't want to, like, say anything or hurt their feelings or anything. Mm-hmm. But, it happens all the time.
Yeah,
And it happens to good improvisers.
Right, yeah.
Because, sometimes that team's not working or what have you, and they shuffle people around. And, there's a certain extent. I said to Aaron last week where it's, there's four times as many people who are good enough to be on Harold or Lloyd at any given time.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, you shuffle around, you're trying to put together a team, and people get cut.
Right.
And
it's built in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's we know it's probably going to happen to somebody.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it a little bit. When you got cut, I imagine you probably, did that throw you, further into the fear zone? Or...
So what happened was, I kind of felt like it was going to happen because I knew that I wasn't playing like myself. I knew that I wasn't happy with the way I was playing, and I wasn't doing what I felt like I showed that I could do in classes and in the auditions. So, I kind of saw it coming, and, being cut and then having that Band-Aid rip off in a way, I think was really freeing, because once you've been cut,
that's
what it is.
It's the Deo Sushi show.
Yeah.
The worst thing has already happened.
Right.
But you're still alive and you can still do improv.
Yeah, totally. And so after that, I just basically, I took a little break. I kind of took stock of, what I had been investing myself in for so long, and tried to compose myself in terms of why did I let this fear take over me in a way?
Mm-hmm.
And then I basically just jumped back into classes. I was like, I do improv because I love it. Improv is fun. This is something that, I personally get a lot of enjoyment out of for the sake of improv. And so I think I just took some time to realize, I put a lot of stake in Harold Knight that I shouldn't have in a way.
A similar but not exactly the same thing happened to me, where it's I had 3 to 4 years of experience under my belt and I didn't get on the Harold Knight.
Right.
And I was sort of I can't get on Harold. I'm never going to get on it. Mm-hmm. And I sort of took a break as well. And then same thing, you know what? I do this because I like doing it.
Right.
And so I took a class, and then that's when I felt I really started to improvise like myself.
Yeah, totally. I would say, same thing happened to me where I just I just took a bunch of classes with people who I, hadn't taken classes with, who were doing different things than had been used to, and, maybe played in a style that I didn't normally play So I just, just going through classes and kind of meeting new folks who were taking those classes and kind of rediscovering why I liked doing improv in the first place, I think was, really helpful for me. And then I started doing a bunch of indie shows again. I was, I think when you get on a house team, it can be tough to also keep up with the indie shows.
There's only so many nights in a week.
Right.
Yeah.
indie shows I think are super important to being close to the community, and it feels kind of fresh in a way that, other shows don't.
And when you make them an event, like mm-hmm. Tesla did,
right?
They still feel fun and satisfying, and you're doing a great show,
right?
But it doesn't have that added pressure of I'm gonna get notes after this.
Yeah,
I know, I'm gonna muff that move, and oh gosh, someone's gonna tell me about it later, and mm-hmm. And so you don't have to live with that pressure. You can just do the show for the sake of doing a fun show.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I spent a lot of time doing that. And then, auditions would come up. I would do, it took me a few auditions before I got back on Lloyd Knight. But then, even auditioning again, I think was do I want to do this again? Do I want to keep jumping back in?
Right.
I think at the time, I can't remember when it was. Yeah, I think I just pretty soon after I started.
Fact checker? Do we have a?
Right. No, it was I started doing auditions, and before that, the auditions were I would go in and I'd be so anxious. I'd be my heart would be pounding.
Gosh, I know that.
I don't think I ever had
feeling.
A good audition. In terms of like a good call. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think I ever came out of that.
One time I ever went out and came out of there feeling even okay was my last time where I got on Herald. Every other time I left being like, I don't know.
Yeah, right. I think before then I felt similarly where I was like, I didn't feel good about that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, but then after that, after I got cut, whenever I would go and do another audition, I would be like, it doesn't matter if I make it a callback or not. I'm just going to go in there and do a couple scenes.
Yeah.
And it felt really like I was kind of surprised at how little pressure I'd put on myself. And
I try to tell when I coach groups and stuff, and you know, Herald auditions are coming up, Lloyd auditions coming up, are like, they're like, what should we do? And like, mm-hmm. I usually drill 2-person scenes with them, but I'm also like, try not to, I don't say try not to care.
Yeah.
But I am saying try not to put so much pressure on yourself.
Right.
Because the last environment that makes for good improv is like, wow, this scene needs to be really good.
Yeah, right.
It's just not going to work.
Yeah, the success rate is like 0%.
Yeah, yeah.
I think having that mindset totally change was, I don't know, it was a night and day difference between like before I got cut and after I got cut.
The next time you're looking for a craft beer, play to the top of your intelligence and make it one of Bronx's Tasty Brews. There's something for every improviser archetype. For the glue, there's the Bronx Banner Ale. For the straight man, there's the Slow Your Roll Session IPA. And there's even the No Resolutions IPA for the wildcard player. You know who you are. Visit thebronxbrewery.com to find a variety that matches your style. And be sure to make your next pint a Bronx. Bronx Brewery is the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Cody Lindquist.
And I'm Charlie Todd.
And we're the hosts of the Two Beers In podcast.
Two Beers In is a tipsy political roundtable where we chug two beers and talk politics with comedians and journalists.
It's like Meet the Press, but funnier with more alcohol.
Our show is recorded live at the UCB Theater in New York City.
Past guests have included MSNBC's Steve Kornacki and writers from The Daily Show, Late Night with Stephen Colbert and Saturday Night Live.
So you came back.
Yeah, I did come back. I came back through Lloyd. So Lloyd had started in that time.
Right.
I think being on a Lloyd team in a way, the way that they structured Lloyd was like smart in that everyone there's no fighting about what form you're going to do,
right,
or what opening you're going to do.
Yeah, it's like you're going to do the pattern game.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And like, it's a little like you have a little less freedom on Lloyd to do a sort of looser Herald.
Right.
But for the sake of people who have just gotten onto a house team, I think mm-hmm. it's probably to your benefit.
Right. I feel like Pattern Game gets a bad rap these days.
Definitely.
It's not like a sexy opening to do, but it's like one of my favorite openings.
It's never sexy, but I teach 301, and like that's where we learn the Pattern Game.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I don't believe that you can do other openings successfully until
right.
you can do a good Pattern Game.
Yeah, totally. I think that... I feel like the Pattern Game is like it's like a Herald in a way, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a structure. It feels like there's like rules to it, but mm-hmm. Really it's however your group chooses to approach that, right? And how they use that, those conventions to create something together, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it exercises the same skills. And so I feel like Pattern Game is like a pure opening in a way, you know?
It's very abstracted, which I think is why some people really struggle with it.
Yeah.
But it is like, if you can do it, it has the DNA of all other
right.
useful openings. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
I mean, I'm like also kind of a heady person anyway.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's just, you know, my nature of gravitating
feel like
towards that type.
We're kind of heady verbal guys, and like the Pattern Game makes a lot of sense because
yeah.
you can just like, you can think through it as it's
right.
happening, and yeah,
mm-hmm.
it makes sense.
Like, you can do things in a Pattern Game. You can say ideas that have no context and have no, like, are very abstract, and then find a way to do that. I think you can do that with other openings, too, but, like...
It's very easy to do
yeah.
in the Pattern Game. Yeah.
Right, and I think that's what maybe some people find a little bit unapproachable about it, is that how do you take this very, like, abstract
Well, I've got
thing,
all these ideas, but
right,
how do I make scene
right.
out of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a trend now towards, like, quasi-scenic type openings with, like, monologue-y or, like, dialogue-y type
mm-hmm.
snippets,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think that that's, like, a comfortable way to start a start an improv scene.
I always think teams are a little afraid to do a pattern game or something that is more abstract and less like showy.
Yeah.
Because people are like, they watch that and think, oh, when's the show starting? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what this is.
Right.
I need the show to start.
Yeah.
But I think if you're invested in a pattern game and if you're invested in an opening that is, I have a lot of students who hate invocation because it's not quite the same as pattern game, but it has some of those elements where it is like, okay, we're talking about this object, but what's the scene?
Right.
But it's like if you're invested in both of those, they can be entertaining to watch.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think it's all in how you sell it.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about the invocation is it also has this structure that I feel like has built in drama, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's laddering up to this thing, and it has kind of like a Shakespearean quality to it where you're trying to, you know, it's a theatrical distillation of an idea. And I feel like that maybe having it baked into the form, maybe some people feel like, oh, well, you know, it feels forced in a way.
Feels gimmicky, yeah.
Right. But, you know, it's like it's in how your team does it. Like I've seen great invocations and I've seen...
Not so great.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got back on Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
Your Lloyd team was?
Huxtable.
Huxtable, that's
which
right.
Which, in retrospect, that team has not, that team name has not aged.
No. Well, I mean, yeah. I believe this was pre.
This was pre, well, current with the scandals, but not public knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, I think one thing that's cool about Lloyd Knight is just that it's, you know, it's a bunch of people all in the same boat, right? And I think.
Talk to me about the difference between like being on Harold Knight pre-Lloyd Knight and then being on Lloyd Knight.
Right. So I think like pre-Lloyd Knight, you know, you're up with like teams that are crushing it and you like loved coming up through the system, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you're in the same show with them. And so like there's I feel like they're like you were talking about before, there's like a big variance level in terms of like the consistency of the teams. And so I think creating a separate performance night where there's all new teams that are in the same boat and working on the same things, I think helps lift all boats in a way, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that's one of the biggest differences. I also think that I feel like with Lloyd Knight, nowadays there's like an expectation, you know, I think you have a year and you're doing your thing. And so like I think there's a focus on team building, right? Like you work on, you don't stop focusing on yourself, but you try to invest in the team.
Yeah.
Obviously that's been there before, but I think that's like more institutional now in a way.
Yeah, which I think is good.
Yeah.
Because it's like if a team comes together, I think your average quality of show goes way up.
Right.
And it's like if your team isn't working so well as a team, you might have good shows, but you're probably also going to have some really terrible shows when like the individual chemistries don't click.
Yeah.
But when you build that team, the baseline becomes higher, I feel like.
So I have a theory about like chemistry in general.
I'm dying to hear it.
So I think basically like what makes good teams click is when everybody on that team gets to do what they do best.
Mm.
So like everyone has a chance to be their best self on that team. And I think the best teams are the ones who can set each other up to do that. And so I think sometimes, you know, there's that feeling of, oh, this team just clicked. Maybe people kind of happen to get into a groove where they were able to, you know, set each other up to do that. I think getting a team that's maybe having trouble finding that groove and getting them to a place where they are a great team means part of that process is figuring out what it is each person does really well and then focusing on getting other people to do that, right? Like getting your teammate to do their best, whatever it is they do well on stage.
Right, right. Like if you're a strong support person, it's like, yeah, let's give this person an opportunity to like do a lot of great support moves.
Right.
Or if, you know, someone's like, they've always got that killer initiation. It's like, let that person initiate, you
know?
It's like, let them get that first line out there that's, you know, already going to, like, start off a great scene.
Right. Or someone's, like, kind of, like, you know, they have a lot of energy and they, you know, take big swings. They're, like, a leadoff hitter in a way, if you will.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Get things going.
Mm-hmm.
You want to create situations where they're able to do that, right? So I feel like a lot of what makes a good team is the recognition of that, of what everyone individually does well, and then creating situations where you get to do that.
Yeah, I completely agree about chemistry. It's like, I think that's true of an improv team or of like a sports team or or like a band.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, let everyone do the thing they're good at.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as it's not like them just out on their own in space.
Yeah.
Like, as long as that's contributing to the show or the game or the music, I think that works pretty much all the time.
I think one exercise that I really love doing with teams, like when I've been coaching or when I've been on new teams, is like setting up, doing scenes that you think that person, like setting up characters that you think each individual person would nail. Right?
I just did this with a group. I stopped coaching this group in our last practice together. Mm-hmm. That's like exactly the exercise we did.
Because
I think it's like, if you're a team that's been together for like, especially like this team had been together for over a year, it's like, you know what kind of characters other members of this team like to play. Let's just do a bunch of scenes where we see those. And it's like, why not do that in a show?
Right.
You know?
Or on even, or also like, what type of scenes or characters that people play that make you laugh? Like, what do you find funny about how they play?
Yeah,
like, set them up to do that too, you know?
They might not even be aware. Like, I was never aware when I was on Bucky that people considered me like a good straight man.
Right.
I just fell into that role a lot because, like, we had a lot of big, like, Frank plays a lot of, like, big characters.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
when we had Nicole Byer, she would play a lot of big characters. And Nate always has these really like obsessive characters about these like one thing.
Right.
And I didn't realize that like frequently what I was really good at in scenes with Bucky was grounding all of those and sort of making sense out of those so that that scene could keep going and keep going.
Yeah, totally. And I think sometimes that changes, like based on
absolutely.
The team. Like maybe
depending on the team.
Maybe you're better at straight manning this particular team, but on other teams, maybe you're more of the wild card in a way. Maybe not the wild card, but maybe you play a different role.
I play differently on Thank You Robot.
Yeah,
it's a different
for sure.
experience.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you find that like is your area like on Mermaids?
So on Mermaids, I don't know. That's a good question. I feel like on Mermaids, I have played the weird guy, like kind of the weird specific
that I believe
role. I've also played the straight man role a lot. I think our team has changed a lot chemistry, like roster wise. So, you know, I think as people bring in new, as new members join, you know, you obviously have to adjust a little bit. Right now I feel like I'm trying to find more opportunities to be the weirdo. Cause I feel like that's something that I personally like to do a lot.
Yeah. I'm same.
Yeah.
But you can't be the weirdo all the time.
Right. Right. You can't be the weirdo all the time. I've definitely been on teams where that's not, what, they're weirder people.
Yeah,
on the team
like,
than I am, and
maybe
I'm like,
you should weird.
Yeah, right.
I'll do something else.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like earlier when I was like on different teams, I was more of like a physical presence. I feel like people used to think of me as someone who would play like monsters and dragons and things like that, like a lot of like non-verbal type of moves. I feel like I don't do that as much anymore, maybe because I'm old and my body's becoming more frail.
I've definitely got less physically adventurous the older I get.
Right, right. It's like kind of sad when you have to leave improv practice, like, I'm kind of sore.
I really messed up my back.
Yeah, that shouldn't be as taxing as it is.
No, but, you know, sometimes you got a character who's like a hunchback or something,
right,
and you're
right.
like, oh, God, I shouldn't have played this. This was a mistake.
Right. But, yeah, I think, you know, that's, to me, what also makes it fun is if, like, you know, people recognize this is the stuff that I personally like to do. And I think like keeping it fresh means finding ways to make yourself laugh in scenes and doing what you like to do in improv. So,
yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
Can I ask when you went, so you're on Herald Night, you get cut, you make it back to Lloyd, and then you make it back to Herald Night.
Yeah.
What was the feeling? You're like, oh my gosh, I'm going from Lloyd to Herald again. Did you? Did you feel that same pressure that you felt like the first time you were on Herald Night or?
Well, so I think what changed was on Lloyd Night before we got before I got moved up to Herald Night, I was on a team that I was hoping would get moved up as a team.
Oh, sure.
I was on a team. I was on First Lady. It was
a team
I really
very,
loved.
Very funny team.
I loved playing on that team, and I thought that we really played well together. And so the goal in my head was for us to move up as a team. And then so like moving up, I think that was such like a different mindset change. Like for me, you know, that's part also part of the Lloyd Knight system, right?
Yeah.
Where it forces you to invest in your team, and now you're not all of a sudden you're not concerned on about
oh, am I going to get moved? But yeah. It's like, hey, our team's really good. We should all get moved.
Yeah. So I think for me, I was bummed that I didn't get to play with First Lady anymore.
Yeah.
I got back on Harold Knight, Harold Knight was, I think I approached it differently. I was just like less fear. I've been through the system twice at this point. And so now, I played with a bunch of peers, right? I got put on side piece.
Very funny.
You coached side piece. Yeah,
I was going to say, I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was really funny, really funny people. It became less about like, oh, I got to not get cut to, oh, I get to play with all these fun folks who I.
Like, how do I have the most fun with these people?
Yeah, totally. I think that was like the biggest difference where I just stopped focusing on not getting cut.
I mean, it's good. It's good advice for the improv world, but it's also good life advice.
Yeah.
Of like, you can't just focus on like not failing.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
It's a terrible goal.
I think you have to like embrace failure, right?
Yeah.
It happens constantly.
You learn the most.
Right.
When you fail.
Yeah. Totally. I think the second time around, I've definitely been having more fun with it and trying to take more risks in a way. Mermaids is a great team that like we kind of take big swings, and I feel like we are good at supporting each other with weird moves and things like that.
I was telling you before we started recording this that like, you know, I teach, and especially my like 201 and 301 students in the last few months have been telling me like, oh, that, I love what Mermaids does. And I think it's because you take those big swings. Like what they described to me always sounds like, oh, they really went, they tried to build like a really crazy world for this show.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, you know, when it comes together, isn't that like the most satisfying thing to see in an improv show?
Oh, yeah, like, totally. I feel like the team is really good at just jumping on simple, dare I say, dumb ideas.
Say dumb.
I think that's liberating in a way to just be like, it doesn't have to be smart. I mean, it will be smart because people are smart, and we approach it and try to approach it in a smart way. But like, we're not precious about it, and we just, you know, just jump on and support the idea.
It's funny because like so much of your life, the word dumb is bad,
right?
But especially in comedy, dumb is really good.
Yeah, dumb is easy. Dumb is easy to understand. It's simple, and it invites participation.
I tell my students all the time, like, "Oh, that scene was so dumb," and then I'm like, and I mean that in the best way possible.
Yeah, right.
of like, it was one idea that we just chased down relentlessly and had so much fun doing. Like, that's what I mean when I'm talking about dumb.
Yeah, I feel like the best comedy bits can be described as dumb.
It's like any great Saturday Night Live like physical character is probably a super dumb idea,
right?
but they're so much fun to watch because it's like it's just like this monomania of like, I'm thinking of Matt Foley, the Chris Farley character,
Down by the River,
Down by the River. But it's like that's one idea.
Right.
He's a motivational speaker who has a terrible life.
Yeah.
But like he puts so much energy into that dumb idea that it's hard not to laugh at that.
And he just commits to it, and that's where you get drawn in, you know?
Yeah.
I think Mermaids is I especially like being able to just put any idea out there and know that my teammates are gonna jump on it.
I mean, I don't think there's a better feeling on a team, right?
Yeah.
Of like, I don't know about this idea, but I'm going to throw it out there.
Right.
And then like 2 minutes later, you're in this really fun scene and you're like, oh, I'm glad I did that.
Yeah.
And my team just like went for it.
Right. I feel like one thing that's kind of different about Mermaids from other teams that I've played on is that I feel like our group games are especially fun in a way. You know, I feel like we are good at, I guess, the pacing of that group dynamic in a way of all adding as many details as we need, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then not too much more.
Because
I feel like our group games tend to be especially simple in a way.
again, like I'm teaching, you know, I teach a 301, we learn group games. Uh-huh. And it's like the desire for students to overcomplicate group games is mm-hmm. massive.
Yeah.
They think it's like a regular scene, whereas like a group game is like the best group games are mm-hmm. like, I'm not sure if this says this in the book, but it is a great shorthand of like a good group game should be 90% yes, 10% and.
Right.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
Of like, just throw out that little bit of information you need every 20 seconds or so and like really jump on the yes mm-hmm. and like just get in there and play it. Like whatever it is, like have fun with it.
Yeah, totally.
What's so like, you know, we're talking about Harold Knight. Like what to you is like, what are the characteristics of a really satisfying Harold?
So yeah, I think obviously when the games are surprising, well, the games take, we end up in surprising moves.
Yeah.
I think those are really satisfying because that's like, you know, the performers discovering it in the moment is one of the best feelings.
I love performing for a Harold Knight audience because they are a super hip improv
yes.
crowd. Like
uh-huh.
they get good improv moves.
Right.
And I think one of the things you get most on Harold Knight is like surprising moves, especially Harold mm-hmm. Knight audiences are like, ah.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I think like, you know, it's all, a lot of it is students who are also critically watching the show.
Who are already thinking, oh, where would I take
yeah,
this game?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, you always, it's a savvier audience. So you want to be a step ahead of that.
And when you can, I think they yeah. are like, this team rules.
Yeah, right. I think when, like I was talking about before, when everyone gets to, everyone gets their hits in, right?
Yeah.
So,
in a classic Overwatch
yeah.
comp, you want to make sure your DPS
you got, yeah,
is doing your damage.
You got a good tank.
Uh huh. You have supports,
good heals.
Giving heals, right?
Right, totally.
They can cut this out there.
yeah. So, I think everyone having their moment in the show is really important. And
mm-hmm.
I think if everyone's having fun in the show and they're playing with each other,
yeah.
I think that's like, you know, it's, you can tell when a team is having fun and enjoy doing scenes with each other.
We, Aaron and I spoke a little bit last week about like technical correctness,
mm-hmm.
about like, oh, well, it's, you know, if you like, it's not really a Harold if you don't do this or that, or where
yeah.
do you stand on that kind of stuff? Because we had kind of an interesting chat about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are a little too precious about the form,
yeah.
right? And I think really it's not about whether you did your second beats in order and you did proper and analogous second beats or whatever. I think it's more whether your team used the form to do to make a funny show, right? Like
yeah.
whether you to do what you thought was funny with it, right? With the idea and with the ideas that you created.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think we did a lot of this stuff in working with Gethard in like Parentheses and in that other class I took with him, where it was just like, you know, fuck the Harold form, right?
You know,
Harold is like kind of a mindset in a way, like it's been drilled into your bones in a way, so you'll come back to and you'll naturally do those things.
Like reflexively, you're
right.
just going to do that stuff.
Because
yeah.
that's sort of, you know, yeah, you'll naturally learn to do those things, but just try to break the form and try to like explore ways to use it to your advantage in the show. That's like a very challenging thing to do, but I think that's how it should be approached in a way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to
yeah.
me. We don't have a ton of time left, but I would actually love to talk about Parentheses for just a
sure.
little bit. So if people don't know, mm-hmm. Parentheses was a Chris Gethard class.
Yeah.
It was on the website and the description of it was bizarre.
Yeah, I think the class name was like the destruction of the arbitrary and something like, I don't know. It was
yeah.
like a purposefully like florid class name.
It was more of a manifesto
yeah,
than
yeah.
like a class name.
And I think there were 27 people in the
yeah.
class.
Yeah, I remember
so,
that.
So I think one of the first things he said was like, one of the arbitrary rules is that a class is 16 people, so we're just going to break that off the
I mean, it makes
bat.
Sense.
And the class was absolutely stacked. It was like...
I mean, it's insane that all those people
yeah.
were in the same class. So many super funny people.
Yeah. And we basically would spend 3 hours doing a lot of... I think one of the big lessons that he was trying to get us to learn was it's about the people you're on stage with, and that's sort of... That is definitely influenced the way I've thought about playing as a team from that point on. It was Like, who are the people you're on stage with? What do they do best? How can you get them to do that on stage?
I was there for that show. I saw at least a couple of them. And the one that I remember, do you remember the backflip one?
Yes, where Murph was going to do a backflip.
Was going to do a backflip. And Mayer could do a backflip and did one on stage to, like, here's how you should do it if you're going to try to do it.
Right. And then
he tried and
ate shit.
In one of the most horrifying moments I've ever seen, just like ate it hard on his neck.
Yeah. It was painful to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think we definitely worked on trying to create these moments on stage that, you know, that are unique, that are, you know, honest in a way, that are, you know, like Murph is kind of like, you know, he's kind of a risk-taking kind of guy.
Absolutely.
And so him it didn't seem like he was going to do a backflip, but like he didn't seem like the kind of person who could pull it off. And then just watching him do it, I think was captivating.
For sure.
Yeah. We would do a lot of, I guess you would say, organic stuff.
Big time.
I remember when, like, our practices, sometimes we would just do stuff that like, it'd be tough to describe it as improv.
Yeah. I mean, the show was like, frequently was just like all over the place, and not in a, that sounds bad, but that's not how, I don't mean it in a bad way. I'm just like, it would just touch on so many different styles and moments and theatrical traditions.
Yeah. Right.
That it was hard to classify it as like, well, I don't know if it's just an improv show.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like an analogy. It feels like a Jackson Pollock in a way, right? Like splatters of things that kind of build up, like kind of lead, they all build on each other and create something maybe like a
more
feeling.
More than you'd expect of like, oh, wow, like I thought he was just like dripping paint. And then you look at the hole and you're like, oh, this is more than what I thought it was.
Right. But yeah, I remember one of the things we did, he would break us up into different groups arbitrarily, and then we would have to like figure out what it is that's unique about us and then about this collection, and then, you know, try to do something that only that collection of people could do.
Oh, that sounds great.
I don't know if I was, I feel like we made a pact not to discuss the things that maybe I'm outing a bunch of secrets, but
I apologize if that's my fault. But
the ethos of the class was basically like, you know, these are folks who have been taking a lot of classes.
It was all people who are really involved in the community.
Yeah, and you know, we've been taught a certain way how to improvise, and so now it's like, can we break those rules down, see what happens when we do, and what's left, and then what is about improv, essentially that is so interesting to watch.
I'll never forget the ending of that backflip show, because it ended, you had pulled some guy out of the audience on stage, and then put him. Murph was in a wheelchair for a bunch of the show.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you put that guy in a wheelchair and all of you lifted him up and made him do a backflip in the wheelchair. And there was something about watching that I was like, oh my, like it was like an hour long show and you would come back to the backflip.
Right.
And I was like, oh man. And then the guy was literally doing one with the aid of all these people.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's terrific.
Yeah. I think there was also something interesting about having 27 people and like trying to do we did some stuff that you couldn't do with just a regular
100%.
Class. Like I remember one time there was one scene where Matt Kleiman and I were just two sailors on a boat, and there was a storm coming, and then the rest of the class kind of just created the waves, created the boat. Kleiman was like, he went up into the crow's nest and was like, "Captain, there's a storm coming," but he was climbing like literal people making a crow's nest, and then he came down, and then I went up into the crow's nest also, and then verified that there was a storm. But this whole time we're like, climbing
like
on people.
A dozen people shifting oh man.
It was kind of like, that's like, you just, that's not something you see in an average improv show.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
It was fun. It was cool.
Thanks for talking about it.
Yeah.
I always wanted to know a little more about what went on behind this. That was a class where I was like, I don't know why I didn't sign up for that.
Yeah. There is like I feel like there's a shroud of mystery around that class, mainly because maybe we've created this shroud of mystery.
Well, you know, sometimes you got to create a shroud of mystery, and that's just what it is.
Yeah.
Jesse, it's been great talking to you about improv.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me as well. So let me do the official outro. And that was a long-form conversation. Tune in next time to the next episode when Jesse Lee will be your host. Thanks, Jesse. And hey, see you on Herald Night.
See you there.
All right.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at ucbtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.
Thanks to the Bronx Brewery, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network, for their support. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for more information on all their craft beers. And be sure to make your next pint a Bronx.